I will reintroduce Paltusik, for I know there's some new people in the, 60 people came in yesterday, so we have some new ones, so great. Hal is a recently retired university professor in United Methodist pastor and one of our favorite faculty, if I can say that we have favorite faculty. Someone asked me yesterday, Hal, how I found you, and I'm like, I had nothing to do with that. But all I can say is that I have the privilege of working with him now. So thank you very much, Hal, and he's going to continue his discussion on the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to make clear, nobody at Holden found me. They were gracious enough to, when I said, could I teach here, say yes. Welcome to those of you who are new. What we're doing is a week of studying the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Luke together through the lens of wisdom literature. What I'm proposing is that both the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Thomas would be considered wisdom literature. So we're looking at them together to see where the kind of wisdom they give is together or whether they're different. How Thomas and Luke as wisdom are similar and separate. We work together by me talking for a few minutes and then you all responding with protests and questions and pause, and you need to be reassured that I can't work without you in that process, and you need to know be also assured that I can stop you if we need to go on. So I'm fairly good at both of those, and I'm really grateful for you helping me along. So today we're going to be looking at Thomas and Luke together and see what kinds of wisdom literature each have. We should say, first of all, that the wisdom sayings in both Gospels are portrayed as having been taught by Jesus. So both Thomas and Luke will say, Jesus said, and then there is a wisdom saying. And if you say, what does he mean by wisdom saying, we're working on that. It is a common kind of literature in the ancient world, and there are a lot of sages or wise people that are learning how to be wise, as a profession sometimes, and sometimes as an avocation. So we find Jesus portrayed primarily as a wisdom teacher in both of these Gospels. I think that to do an overview of that, look at the wisdom of both. I direct you first to the second side of the handout, which says the ways, there's a right here on the reverse side, there's a head, subhead that says the ways that the Gospels of Thomas and Luke respectively voice ancient wisdom. And so we're going to look at that chart, I think, briefly, and then we're going to go back to the front of the handout and work our way through a number of sayings of both, and that will not be so much a comparison as a sort of a flow through the kinds of wisdom. So, but also on the back, you'll see Thomas on the left hand side and Luke on the right. No wisdom appropriate in left and right, as far as I'm concerned. Well, you notice on both sides, I'm talking about the figure of wisdom. Now that is something that I need to double check with you on. Do you all know that there is a person in the Bible called wisdom? So someone's shaking their head no. Thank you for saying that. I see a couple of people. There is in both the First Testament and the Second Testament, there is a figure called Wisdom, and she speaks. You'll find the biggest portrait of wisdom in the book of Proverbs. The first 9 chapters of the book of Proverbs portrays this divine figure who comes from above and comes to teach people and then goes back up to above. And her name is Wisdom. If you think that nobody has that name, you can, what scholars started doing about a century ago in trying to portray this, they just took the ancient Greek word, or the modern Greek word as well, for wisdom, which is
Sophia.
So if you want to call her Sophia, this figure in the Old and New Testament, then you can do that. In other words, she's a character, and she's a divine character. You'll notice that I am saying that it's wisdom is a she. It's clear from the texts that's the way the biblical texts look at it. I've written 2 books on wisdom as divine female, and the United Methodist Church, for whom I am ordained, brought me and my co-authors up on heresy for teaching about a divine female in the Bible. Mm-hmm. We were exonerated. Some people congratulate me on that, and some people don't. For those of you who might be Methodist, you can know that the Council of Bishops was prompted by our 2 books to study wisdom in the Bible, and they then told the entire Methodist Church, "Yeah, she's there." They didn't want to talk about her as female too much. So anyway, this figure of wisdom is, that's not all the wisdom literature is, but the figure of wisdom is a divine person. And in both Thomas and Luke, she is compared to Jesus. So and we'll see that a little bit, and if you want me to go into that, we can, but I don't really particularly want this course to become a Wisdom Sophia course, because I've done that 3 years ago here. But I want us to get more complicated and see how Wisdom Sophia and Jesus are in the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Thomas. So, but anyway, the figure of Wisdom Sophia and Jesus are similar or the same in the Gospel of Thomas. That's on the left. In the right, the figure or person of Wisdom Sophia and Jesus are sometimes similar, sometimes the same, and sometimes different. So both are playing with the fact that who Jesus really is divine wisdom who comes down to visit people and give them wisdom. Comparisons would be the Gospel of Thomas on the left consists entirely of aphorisms, parables, and proverbs. We went over that yesterday, but for those of you who are new, so these are 3 kinds of wisdom literature. And in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus only talks. Jesus doesn't do anything. 114 short chapters in which it's just Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said. And in the Gospel of Luke, on the right-hand side, that is a story. The Gospel of Thomas is not a story. It's just a bunch of sayings. It is a bunch of sayings. To say it's just a bunch of sayings would say that anybody with a story is better than anybody with a bunch of sayings. But so the Luke is a story in which Jesus sometimes speaks in wise aphorisms, parables, and proverbs. Let me note here that in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus doesn't always speak in wisdom language. For instance, in chapter 21 in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus predicts the end of the world in a bunch of ways. That's wisdom. Sages are not interested in that topic of prediction generally, and especially prediction of a cataclysmic end. So there would be a part of the Gospel of Luke in which Jesus is not talking in wisdom language. We'll do a third one down comparison. On the left, the Gospel of Thomas teaches aphoristically and wisely. And I'm using that technically, not smart, but just he has a wisdom style. The way the historical Jesus probably taught. Now let me unpack that just for a moment. I'm using here the idea that has emerged in the last 200 years that since Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Mary, Thomas, and other Gospels all have different portraits of Jesus. One needs to think, since so many of the Gospels are different, for instance, Mark, the way Jesus talks in Mark, and the way Jesus talks in John, what Jesus does in Mark, and what Jesus does in John, are often different. So that realization has made people say, well, who is the historical Jesus? Meaning, who is the Jesus that lived long ago? So what I'm wanting us to notice here is that probably the historical Jesus, and I have to say this again, excuse me, but those of you who are new, I'm a fraud. Being a historian of the ancient world and of 20 centuries ago, you can't be right all the time. Matter of fact, it's really hard to know historically accurate things. So it's a valid question for us to say, who was the historical Jesus? I'm not saying who's the real Jesus, because for me, the real Jesus is now. But it is a valid question to say, of the differences in, let's say, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Thomas, Mary, as Gospels, it's a valid question to say, so who was how much of this did Jesus really say in each of the Gospels, since they're often different? So what I'm wanting to say here about Thomas is that it looks like Jesus was a sage. The historical Jesus, most scholars think, was a person who taught like other wisdom teachers, in this vein of tiny little sayings that were smart and helpful. Remember the parables. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have Jesus teaching these tiny little stories called parables. John doesn't have any. So I'm wanting to say the way Jesus sounds in Thomas is the way probably the historical Jesus sounded. Let's walk across the page there. The Gospel of Luke sometimes teaches this wisdom way that the historical Jesus taught, and sometimes not. So this is interesting. I would want to say the majority of the sayings we have of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke sound like who we think the historical Jesus was. But sometimes doesn't. In Thomas, it's not that Jesus said all of the things that is in Thomas, but it sounds like the way he would talk. Well, that could be a dicey distinction. I've done that now 3 times. Let's, as usual, let's stop and have you think about these 3 comparisons between wisdom in the Gospel of Thomas and Luke. Yes?
Is there any connection that Luke may have been the place where Thomas pulled out the things he liked?
Oh.
Historically?
Oh, yeah. So just to repeat that question, because it's a complicated one, here's a suggestion that where Thomas got the wisdom sayings was in Luke. That when we first found, when we first discovered the Gospel of Thomas in 1945 and worked on it for 60 years, and we're still working on it, this is really a working on it session. We're still trying to figure out a lot about Thomas. That was the first idea, that basically Thomas was composed by taking things from both Luke and Matthew. Almost no scholars believe that anymore. That the relationship to of sayings in Thomas and Luke are way more complicated. So, for instance, you could say the historical Jesus said something and both Thomas and Luke got to know about it. It turns out that's even more complicated than that, because probably Luke almost certainly has copied many of Jesus' sayings from Mark and has changed them. It doesn't look like Mark and Thomas are related in terms of trajectories of sayings. They seem to be really, they have some of the same sayings, but they're always a different enough for us to say, we don't understand this. We don't understand how it came. Yes?
Does the character of Jesus portrayed by Thomas appear to be consistent with the Jesus we know from the Gospels? Or is he a different guy?
That's such a great question, and I'm going to give you an answer that is neither.
Okay.
So first of all, I have to say, and again, we overlook this, that for instance, the Gospel of Jesus and the Gospel of Mark talks and acts different than Jesus and the Gospel of John. So we can't say the Jesus we know in the Gospel. Because the Jesus of Mark is different than the Jesus of John in a number of ways. Not in all ways, but in some ways. So, for instance, the Jesus of John, as I said before, doesn't teach any parables. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus teaches primarily parables. So back to your question, I'm not avoiding you. I would just want to then add Thomas to the list and say there are 5, if you just count Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas, you have 5 Jesuses. They overlap, but you can't say that they're the same. I mean, you can say that they're the same, but then you have real trouble when you read them. Okay, other thoughts and questions? Yes?
You were saying yesterday about that sages often got their start sort of in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Which makes sense why you would use these sort of short aphoristic speeches. I'm just wondering, is there any study on like the context in which Jesus's various modes of rhetoric took place, right? So you can see how if you were before a huge crowd, using a shorter, pithier saying, right, would like be quicker and make more sense, you know, like a tweet, if you will.
Right, yeah.
Right? Whereas if you're with your disciples in a more intimate setting, like maybe then there's more time for a parable, right? I'm just wondering if there's any, like, is there a relationship between the supposed size of the crowd or the specific physical context where Jesus is speaking and the kind of rhetorical mode he's using.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is, yes, there is a relationship, but we have no idea what it is. Because the picture of different settings in which Jesus taught vary from gospel to gospel as well. And the sizes of the crowd are almost certainly, depending on the perspective of the gospel writer, portrayed as big, medium-sized, or small. In other words, I've said this in other years here, but so one of my main mentors was a person, a teacher that I studied in France with, and he was a Roman Catholic cardinal, he would say to me, I mean, this is a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church, thank God they didn't write down what happened. Thank God they wrote down what it meant. And here's where the location, not of Jesus, but the location of the writing of the Gospels comes in. Because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Thomas, and Mary, and all those Gospels have different constituencies. So for instance, yesterday we were talking about, it looks like the Gospel of Luke is the first writer of a Gospel that doesn't have one community it's writing for. Luke is probably the first Gospel writing, not that was written, but the first Gospel writing that is written for a bunch of different communities. So I dodged your question, not intentionally, but because I don't know. Is there something I missed in that, because it was a great question?
No. The Thomas is just aphorisms, I was like,
right.
Maybe that's just from certain specific contexts or different, I don't know.
Well, but that does help me say some more to get on the table in this mess that I'm creating. So I mentioned this yesterday. So for instance, Jesus doesn't know how to read and write in all the Gospels except Luke. Luke is the only Gospel where Jesus seems to know how to read and write. There's one setting in Nazareth where Jesus stands up and reads a story. That's only in Luke. So what we think is, Jesus almost certainly was, like most sages, an illiterate sage. Therefore, in other words, all his wisdom, and when you read the Proverbs, which are all wisdom sayings, they're all short enough for someone to do it orally. And it looks like the creative thing that happens with real sages is they will say, they will give a proverb or an aphorism of like, what can we say about the kingdom of God? As Jesus often starts with that. And then he gives like two sentences. And the parables are hardly ever over three or four sentences. Then somebody, probably another sage in the marketplace, the next day said, well, here's what I think we can say about the kingdom of God. And it would be some of what Jesus said and something different. So in other words, this is an ongoing dialogue in the public sphere about how can we think about God.
And the shape of the audience contributes to what...
Absolutely. And often you will have a reference to what the audience said in the parable or the aphorism or the proverb itself.
So we should listen to sermons, I guess.
Sermons come later.
Okay.
I mean, probably a good 100 years later. So you see why I keep asking for your protests. Yes.
I haven't ever thought about whether, I guess I always assumed that Jesus wasn't literate.
Was not?
Yeah. But I think that paired with that, I thought that maybe Luke was, you know, fleshing out the reference in that passage, or the writer of Luke, and maybe he referred to it, or maybe he knew. I'm sure people knew more by heart than we memorize now. Mm-hmm. Too. You could have really long passages in your mind.
Yeah, non-literate societies are better at remembering. Yeah, across.
I'm just trying to wrestle with that.
Yeah, exactly. And so the thing that is hard for us to remember is that only 5 or 10% of everybody in Israel knew how to read or write.
Right.
And so the primary way of talking about everything you know is oral. And yes, Luke's Greek is by far the most literate we have. Mark makes all kinds of grammar errors, and it's clear that Mark was written by someone whose first language was not Greek. But Luke is unbelievable. So as I was saying yesterday, Luke kind of gives Jesus some of his own abilities.
Yeah. With all the references that there are in the Bible about Jesus quoting from the Old Testament, how did he learn that if he wasn't literate? He wasn't totally inspired by God to say all of those things. He knew them. And the people who were listening to him knew them too because they had memorized it. But to be able to memorize it, you have to be able to read. Is an oral tradition too, right?
Right.
Yeah. So he may have learned it just from that, rather than reading it. Mm-hmm.
So let me show you how many things I don't know to respond. So yes, primarily as we were saying before. And this is the amazing thing about having wisdom literature, is that it's stuff that's written down by an oral culture. In that way, it's going the opposite direction. Yes, there's it's almost sure that people in Israel in the first century have been taught parts of the Bible orally. Occasionally, they have heard someone read it. But mostly it's an oral culture. I mean, some of you know the great stories from Africa that are coming forth, where there are entire tribes that know their whole history orally. The Buddhist teachings are, and some of the Hindu teachings are really strongly, first, even now, oral. So in those Eastern places, it's not even fashionable to write something. It's fashionable to have it in your body. Then the other thing to throw in is that it's pretty clear, as I think you described back here, it's pretty clear that Luke gives Jesus some scriptural knowledge. I mean, in his story. Because Luke has it all written down. And so that is in many other things that Luke has written, whoever Luke is. Again, obviously I can't clarify.
Well, even the magnitude of living in an oral tradition where everybody is continuing to talk, refine, and slant, or whatever, the story.
Yeah.
We have trouble.
It's true. In other words, one can occasionally think that being in the social media world is similar to an oral culture. In other words, you can change that in a flash. I'm going to go on. Thanks for you see how much more we all get to think when we include your thoughts. And down to number 4, the Gospels, Jesus and Thomas was a thorough sage. a wise person, in whom divine wisdom dwelled. Now, did you notice I put the capital W there because I'm referring to wisdom herself. Let me read you from the wisdom of Solomon in the Catholic and Episcopalian versions of the Bible. Although alone, she can do all, this is wisdom Sophia, herself unchanging, she makes all things new. Now here's what I want us to notice. In each generation, she passes into holy souls. She makes them friends of God and prophets. So this is a new picture of the encounter between the divine and human for most of us. This has a picture of divine wisdom coming in every generation and entering into people, giving them wisdom. So the word God didn't even appear in those sentences, right? But this is the divine messenger from God. It's not a human person, it's a divine person. Like one might say an angel is, or a divine appearance. But here, it's much more thoughtful. So it's like wisdom herself comes down and enters you, and you become wise. So what I want to say here is in Thomas, the picture of Jesus' relationship to the divine is through wisdom herself. She enters him. So the Gospels, Thomas's Gospel, Jesus was a thorough sage in whom divine wisdom dwelt. She came into him. Notice how Luke thinks about this. The Gospel of Jesus in Luke was hybrid, mixture of sage, hero, martyr, and God. Remember, in Luke, Jesus is divine himself. And killed as a martyr, and a wisdom teacher, and a hero. So because Luke is in story form, Luke breaks the wisdom model and keeps it in chunks. Keep those questions or thoughts. The next comparison, Thomas's gospel was probably composed in multiple layers and settings by groups of sages. So again, we're new at listening to Thomas. We've only got three generations or so that have done that. We've had a lot more with Luke. But right now we're thinking that how Thomas got composed is one generation thinks about maybe the first generation is Jesus and Jesus's sage friends. That eventually gets written. The next generation reads that and as sages says, how about this one too? So the next generation adds sayings. And that goes on, we think, for several generations. And the Gospel of Thomas that we have now was built on blocks of sages composed by sages, including Jesus. How do we think about how the Gospel of Luke was written? This gospel's composition probably integrated previous collections of wise sayings into multiple stages of gospel narratives. Now that's a mouthful. But you can read that four or five times and it might be helpful. But I want to just say, for instance, most people think that when Luke wrote Luke's gospel, let's say in 120, we're not sure about that. When Luke was doing that, Luke had the Gospel of Mark written in front of Luke. So there's tons of stuff that is taken directly from Mark into Luke, some of which gets changed in letting Mark get into Luke, and some of which is exactly the same. So what we're now thinking is, how did all this wisdom literature get in? Partly from Mark, but also probably from other chunks of wisdom sayings that Luke integrated into the story of Jesus. So notice, sages don't care about story. Jesus is good enough without having a story for wisdom. But Luke gives Jesus a larger frame in which that wisdom is in there, but other stuff too. So for instance, like Jesus getting killed, Jesus resurrecting. Thomas and the sages are not particularly interested. They think what Jesus says is enough for an ongoing relationship with God. You're going to stop for those three comparisons. Yes?
Take it from your last saying, you seem to distinguish pretty sharply between a Jesus known through a collection of wisdom sayings and a Jesus known through story. I have trouble making the distinction that sharp because, I'm trying to think of an analogy here, and I'm no expert, but Socrates, there's a story with Socrates, and there are wisdom sayings. The Old Testament prophets, some of them there are stories, some of them also miracle stories with some of them, and then there are wise sayings that are passed on. There seems to have been an ancient culture, I've seen it with retired clergy, also, let's collect some of the favorite sayings of Pastor X. Mm-hmm. But they're only collected because they really liked Pastor X, and she was not going to be part of their lives, and by collecting the sayings, we can remember her a little better. So those don't seem to me to be total, necessarily separate kinds of remembrances. To have a sayings collection doesn't mean they didn't care about story.
I was with you up until that last sentence. I wanted to completely agree with you that there are all kinds of mixes of it all, both are in oral form and in written form. Why I'm not sure that the last sentence of why would you think that there are just stories, just sayings, is because there are. In other words, if we have a bunch of books that are just saying, and it turns out that Thomas, in the 19th century, a whole bunch of readers of Matthew, Mark, and Luke said, there must have been packages of just sayings. Because you looked at how Mark and Matthew and Luke said it differently. So for instance, the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew is in a different place in the story than it is in Luke, and it's not called the Sermon on the Mount, it's called the Sermon on the Plain. And so they, in 150 years ago, they were saying, when we're trying to figure out how these story gospels get all this together, there must have been some collection written. Now we found so Thomas was the first one we found with a beginning and an end, saying, this is the beginning, this is the end, this is what I'm doing, I'm writing just sayings. And then we knew already that there are all kinds of other collections that are just sayings. So that's why we think that. Mm-hmm. Again, I think there's a half a chance, 50% chance that I'm just making that up. Why?
I don't think we're disagreeing, but
no, I don't.
I'll just stick with Proverbs, for example. Then you yesterday and today, first nine chapters, did you say, talked more about the person of wisdom, and then we get
right.
in more into the wisdom
right.
saying. There too, there. That's a story of sorts. Mm-hmm. We pay attention to this because these are the aphorisms of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The source for the people used to posit behind Luke. They paid attention to them because they were sayings of Jesus, but there was something that made it beyond the sayings themselves. Seems to me there was an interest in a person, the person, or the divine person.
Yeah, that's where I am, is just that I think anciently there are a lot of ways of following a teacher which don't involve caring what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And there I would, yeah, Proverbs and Thomas are now among a mounting group of things we've discovered about that.
Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure. Somebody may have been writing joke books.
No, we do. We know for
we
sure.
Know there are.
So, we know for
so,
sure there are.
So what gets held on to and what becomes significant becomes part of the ongoing unfolding, too, is distinguishing why was that written, what was the purpose of that. And today, again, we're doing that again with everyone's an author with the internet and how to know the truth so we can be free.
Yeah.
It becomes a huge
right.
part of our lives.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, anciently, the difference between us now and then is, in the ancient world, no one wanted to be known as an author. Almost now, everybody wants to be an author. And so, in other words, the people who wrote stuff in the ancient world intentionally hid themselves. And if they gave a name in their collection or their story, they made up someone they admired. Okay, this little thing we're going through was going to be 15 minutes of our thing, and then we're going to go on to the big thing. I'm going to keep on doing this. This is really great to go back and forth. The last three. The gospel, this is Thomas. The gospel's lack of a need of story differs from the narrative gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Mary, and infancy Thomas. In other words, kind of what we were saying. What we need to know about how the gospel of Thomas is it doesn't seem to need a story, but that's really different than a whole bunch of other things written at the same time, including Luke. Look over at Luke. This gospel's combination of story wisdom differs from Gospel of Thomas, Revelation to John, and the Gospel of Hebrews. And also the letter of Hebrews, by the way, as well. In other words, here, I want us, in both cases, we have a kind of space for wisdom that are different in each of those, and that are different from a whole bunch of other things. So Revelation to John doesn't really have a story. But it's not at all wisdom. It's vision. Next one down. On the Thomas. Thomas's gospel focus on pithy teachings that relates to a variety of persons differs from the letters of Paul, which focus on a particular group of addressees. In other words, here I just want us to notice another difference. So Thomas has a whole bunch of sayings that it assumes different people will like. Paul writes to people he knows and knows why that he wants to make a particular connection. I don't think Thomas wants to make a particular connection. Rather, it's a whole bunch of sayings. Pick a couple. Or pick 10 or 20. Or make up your own. Across there, Luke's gospel use of both pithy wisdom teachings and colorful characters in a story differ from the letters of Paul too. Right? So Luke has got a grand sweep of story and wisdom. And still, Paul's just interested in the folks in Philippi. That Paul completely says regularly, I know who you are, and I like you, or I don't like you, or this is what you should do, or this is what I have to apologize for. On the left, last, Thomas's gospel's commitment to the beginning of the life and creation differs strongly from both Paul's letters and the Revelation's focus on the end. What you'll see in Thomas, in Thomas has a number of sayings in which his followers will come up and say, could you tell us how this is all going to turn out? And Jesus regularly says, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in you grounding yourself in the beginning, meaning the story of God's creation. So, so in that way, Thomas is creation base, whereas Paul is writing a fair amount about how the end is going to come, as well as the Revelation is almost only interested in that. Luke's toning down of a violent end to the world and its strong use of wisdom sayings differs from the Revelation and Paul's letters. So notice I'm not, here in these last three, I'm not interested in making contrast between Thomas and Luke. I'm interested in showing contrast in each of them from other stuff that we know too. Kind of what I call the big family of early Christian writings. And there's so many different kinds of writings for different purposes.
In that sense,
yes, let's the
climax has already occurred then, and everything since then is the ongoing creative response of God's people rather than building to some new description of the ending or whatever. So this keeps going out.
Which does?
The whole idea of life and purpose and what God wants for us. I think we'll treat resurrection and conquering of evil as a victory for God, but I sometimes think that we forget that that's happened, and now we can go out much more freely because we're not worried about the end.
Okay. Oh, that was a saying,
yeah.
How those people who are interested in the end helps you, yeah. And others.
Do you think Jesus was interested in the end?
Do I think Jesus was
interested? Based on the writings and,
yeah,
and
well,
apparent apocrypha, or is that somebody else interested in the end?
I think I would need to ask you which Jesus. So, for instance, the real Jesus is the Jesus now that comes to us regularly. And walking and talking with us, yes. So the answer would be yes, that Jesus is interested in ends. And the end. I've already said that I think that Jesus, the historical Jesus, seems to be a sage, a wise person. And those folks were much more interested in God's presence now and what happened before in the creation, not in Israel. So wisdom leaders are hardly interested in Israel. They're interested in the really early beginning, and that's when creation happens. And they think creation is ongoing.
I guess what I'm really thinking about is not Jesus at all, but why so much of our life or our language or milieu currently is apocalyptic thinking.
Yeah.
Although I guess it's what we're doing with the creation is makes it more real, but left behind books and stuff like that, that, you know, there's going to be this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wake up every morning wishing I knew what the end was. At least these days.
God must really like his creation if he did the whole thing with Jesus so that it could be restored. And we keep trying to be active in determining what it is rather than enjoying the ride.
A sage would say that, yeah. Okay, so 5 minutes to do the important part of what I have to say. So we'll probably pick up a bunch of this tomorrow. But here we have just real text, the first two of which we started yesterday, and to just add this to the, for the, so let's just look, do that quickly. So there's Gospel of the first three, rather. Gospel of Thomas 2. Jesus said, let the ones who seek continue seeking until he or she finds. When that one finds, that one will become troubled. When that one becomes troubled, that one will be astonished, and that one will rule over all. We read that yesterday. So this is a version of seek and you will find. But it's a complicated version in which your seeking makes you first troubled, then astonished, and then figuring it all out. Here's another verse from Thomas. She who seeks will find, and she who knocks will be let in. Now that's almost exactly the same as the next one down from Luke. Jesus said, and I tell you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. She who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, it will be opened. What father among you, if his child asks for a fish, will instead of a fish give him a serpent? Or if his child asks for an egg, will be given a scorpion? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more God in heaven gives the Holy Spirit to those who ask? So you notice the relationship between seek and you shall find, right? There's a lot of similarity and assurance. And this is so wisdom-like. If you really seek of what's important and meaningful, you'll find it. So that, in other words, in both of these Jesus collections, you have a reassurance. Hey, you wondering what to do? You wondering what is meaningful? Just seek it, and it'll be there. In Thomas, on the way, you're going to be troubled as you seek it and find it. In Luke, this will be a major, this will show how God is going to give you the Holy Spirit. So part in Luke, a part of seeking working out has to do with God giving us the Holy Spirit. So similarities and differences, both wisdom saying. Let's go one more for Thomas and that may, yeah, well, I better hurry. Fourth one down. Jesus said, if those who need you say to you, the realm is in the sky, then the birds of the sky will precede you. That's a joke, right? It's a kind of a funny thing. If you think it's just in the sky, the birds are going to be there first. If they say to you, it is in the sea, then the fish of the sea will precede you. Rather, the realm is inside of you and it is outside of you. When you come to know yourselves, then you will become known and you will realize that it is you who are the children of God. But if you are not, if you will not know yourselves, you will dwell in poverty and it is you who are that poverty. So this is an extension of the seek and you shall find, right? With the critique. If you, when you're seeking, if you think it's only up there, then the birds are going to beat you to it anyway. But what you, what, when you're seeking, what you will find deepest will be inside you. And then you will become known and you will realize that it is you who are the children of God. But if you don't find inside you, if you don't find God inside you, you will be poverty itself.
And if we live in fear, we mostly try to hide that
which you know, the mower is...
I said, because so often we live in fear, instead of light, try to hide what's inside.
All right, so tomorrow we're going to go, we've got about three more sayings to look at in Luke and three more sayings in John. There's one amazing connection that is really mind-boggling. The story of both of the Gospels have the story of the owner who gives his vineyard to some people to take care of, and then something happens. In both Gospels, it's sort of the same and sort of really different. Thanks.